Great. Thank you, Caroline. And good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everyone. Really happy to be here with you. I want to express my gratitude to Caroline and to Jake from Sangha Live and all the folks who are helping make this happen in the background that we could all be here together. And even though I won't be able to read the chat as it's coming through, as Caroline said, she's watching the Q&A and she will be forwarding your questions to me. So questions about your practice, the talk, the teachings, we will be able to have some interaction there, which I'm looking forward to. So why don't we start with some meditation together? I invite you to find a comfortable posture if you haven't already. And I often find it really helpful to pay attention to how we begin a meditation. So just really easing into it, rather than coming with a sense of a big agenda or a lot of effort, like now I'm going to meditate. What's it like to just settle back into yourself? Maybe take a few deep breaths. I often like to look around the room where I am. Even though I've spent many hours in this room over the last year of our global pandemic, still just letting the organism take in the physical surroundings is a way of downshifting in your nervous system. So noticing the sights, noticing the feeling of the place, the temperature, and just kind of leaving a little bit of space. So we each have the capacity to be in a mode of receptivity, a mode of being rather than doing. And that's a very natural state for our organism, but it's one that we tend to override by always being so busy and focusing on the external world. So as you come into your meditation posture, as you allow the body to come to stillness, what's it like to invite this orientation of receptivity? So rather than trying to go somewhere to get something, to focus the mind, just settling back into yourself, maybe begin to feel the weight of the body resting on the chair, the floor, the ground. Allowing the visual field to touch the eyes, allowing sounds to touch the ears. You can allow the eyes to close if that feels comfortable, or just gazing down at the ground. And if you like, perhaps just beginning by noticing sounds. Noticing the sounds in the room or outside where you are. Noticing the sound of my voice come and go. Seeing if you can give all of your attention to the experience of hearing. And there may be thoughts or sensations or emotions that are also present for you. See if you can just allow those to be more in the background of your awareness. Giving more attention to the experience of hearing. Noticing the texture of sound, different qualities of vibration, And as you settle into this space of listening, receiving, refining your attention to hear even the most subtle sounds, you might also notice the quality of listening itself. In your own heart and mind, there's a quiet receptivity. That's awake, that's aware, that's sensitive. This quality of listening can help us recognize the quality of awareness in our own heart and mind, that we are awake right here and now. And all that we experience in our mind and body, the physical senses, the mental and emotional realm, that all of that occurs and is known within awareness. It's so easy to overlook because it's so subtle, so ever present. The capacity to receive, to listen, to be aware. And perhaps noticing how that awareness registers the body. How do you know that you're sitting, reclining, or standing right now? Not in your thoughts, not with your eyes. The very felt experience of being in a body. Its weight, its pressure, its warmth. How the limbs are disposed, the various areas and zones of pressure, lightness, or heaviness. And becoming fully conscious of the body, feeling the sensations of the body, whatever posture it's in. And the body is being known, being felt in awareness. Just as there can be this quiet listening and receiving of sounds, there's this quiet sensing in the body, a receptivity to tactile sensations that's awake, that's aware. So sometimes this wakeful quality of the heart and mind is so clear, so strong that we can just rest with it. But oftentimes there's enough busyness, enough activity in the mind or the body that we get swept up, we overlook it. And so it's helpful to use some kind of a reference point or an anchor to stay present. So you might allow your attention to settle with your hands in your lap. You might notice the rhythm of breathing and the sensations as your body breathes in and out. You might continue to notice sounds, so trusting your own intuition and intelligence to choose where to rest your attention in a way that feels supportive, grounding, accessible. And then pay attention to what takes you out of the present moment. What captures your attention? Does the mind just drift and wander, kind of dithering in thoughts, meandering? Is there some idea that arises that you need to accomplish something? Here in the meditation, I have to get more concentrated. I have to focus. I need to stop thinking. And you begin trying to get somewhere, to do something that takes you out of what's happening right now. And perhaps there's some difficult emotions, or pain in the body, the heart, or the mind that's impinging on your awareness, taking up a lot of space, calling your attention. So whatever it is, whatever takes you out of the present moment, bringing a quality of kindness and gentleness to that process. Remember, we're learning. That's why it's called practice. What are we learning? We're learning how to arrive, how to wake up to our life, how to find balance with what's happening, and how to understand this heart and mind and body. So instead of trying to make something happen or change what's happening, we're waking up to the way things are. When the mind is distracted or lost, no problem. This too can be known in awareness. If we're trying too hard, struggling or striving, no problem. this too can be known in awareness right here, right now. If we're in pain, afraid, confused, lost, grieving, worried, no problem. It's just that, it's uncomfortable. This too can be known in awareness. So let's continue to practice together like this quietly, using the anchor to steady yourself, allowing experience to unfold moment to moment, thoughts, sensations, memories, different moods or emotions coming through like weather, just allowing what is to be known. And coming back again and again to this capacity for listening, for awareness, that's enough in this moment. bringing so much love, so much friendliness and gentleness to whatever is happening. The Dhamma is revealing itself to us moment by moment, showing us the truth of change. The truth of inconstancy, that we're not in control. So instead of struggling and fighting with reality, invite a quality of humility and warmth. Ah, I see, this is how it is right now. Let me be with this. Taking refuge in awareness, in this capacity to be awake, to find balance with the way things are from moment to moment. Thank you. Thank you for joining me for that. It's always sweet for me to get to practice together, even in this kind of virtual remote setting. And one of the real gifts of being in the Dharma together is that getting this offering of time and space to be with the heart and the mind, to touch into a level of quiet that's available in the midst of life, in the midst of busyness. So I hope that each of you is well enough today. I wanted to share some reflections about our practice and about one particular shift, kind of at the foundation or the basis of meditation practice, that can make all of the difference in how we approach the meditation, how we approach our life, and the level of nourishment that we receive from our spiritual practice. I'm guessing that most of you, like me, are familiar with the experience in meditation of feeling like the goal of the practice is kind of receding. This very common experience we have in life, actually, not just in meditation. We look forward to something, we put a lot of energy and effort into it, and then somehow, not all of the time, but it seems to me a lot of the time, we get there, and by the time we get there, we're already looking forward to something else. And it's like that cartoon, you know, of a man riding a donkey or a horse with a stick and a carrot in front, and the donkey never gets there because every step you take, it just gets further away. So I remember, I grew up in New Jersey in the East Coast, the Northeast of the United States, in a suburb. And I was raised in a Jewish family, a lot of emphasis on education. So I, you know, put a lot of focus into school because that was what was expected of me and how I received praise and attention. And I was a good student. And I remember at various points as a kid, as early as like 7 years old, maybe eight, waking up one morning and going to my mom and saying, I just want to get on with it already. Like, what's the point? If the point of going to school is to get to go to college, and the point of going to college is so that you can get a job, so you can have a family, why do I have to wait so long? Why can't I just go and do it? It's like, even at that early age, I sensed the inherent pattern of the receding goal. You know, go to elementary school so you can go to middle school, so you can do this, so you can do this, everything kind of leading to something else. And I was already thinking like, well, when do I get there, right? When do I get there? And why do I have to wait to get there? And this pattern of placing our fulfillment in some goal in the future, whether it's the job, the relationship, being out of debt, having a healthier body, getting the vaccine, you know, being able to go out and see friends, whatever it is, underneath it, if we look closely, we can see is this pattern of discontent or simply overlooking the present for an imagined future. And that pattern gets carried into our meditation practice. So we come to meditation, each of us, I think, for different reasons. And there's some main categories of reasons why we come. Many of us are suffering emotionally, psychologically, physically, and we want relief. We might be curious about what it is to be human, what it is to be alive. We might be working for change in our community or the world and be depleted and be seeking a different way of approaching social change that's more sustainable, that's more balanced. And indeed, the paradox here is that spiritual practice can provide many of these benefits. And in fact, you know, the promise of the Buddha's teachings is relief from suffering. That's the whole goal, is to end suffering. What we learn, though, is that the end of suffering doesn't come in the future. It's not a goal that we get to. It's something that we recognize and discover in the present moment. There's a famous story, a famous analogy that occurs in different traditions throughout the world of a person who has a dream about a treasure and that's far away. And they discount it and they keep having this dream. And so finally one day, a very, very poor family, this very poor person. And finally one day they decide, they've had the dream so many times, they're gonna go to this city in their dream and see if they can find the place that they see in their dream where this treasure is buried. And so they go on this long journey and they get to this city and they ask and they finally come to this one little house and they realize this is the house. This is the house that I've seen in my dream. And they knock on the door and they talk to the owner and they say, this is gonna sound crazy, I know, but I've come a long distance and I've been having this dream for years. And it's your house in the dream. And in the dream, there's a treasure in your backyard. And the person in the house laughs at them and they say, how foolish you are. If I followed every dream I had, you know, he said, I've been having the same dream. And he describes to the traveler a house. And as he describes it, the traveler realizes it's his house. And he tells him that he's been having this dream that there's a treasure buried in the backyard of this house. And he said, I would, you know, where would I be? I would be traveling like you, a fool. So the traveler says, thank you. And then he takes this long journey back home and he gets home and he goes into his backyard and he digs in the place where the person who had the dream says, and he digs and there he finds in his own backyard the treasure. And there are different versions of this story. The essential point of the allegory being that that which we seek is right here, waiting for us in our own home, in our own heart. But we have to go on a journey often to realize it. And that through that journey, we arrive back where we started from, but in a different way, in a different place. So one of the things that we realize on the journey, one of the things that we come to see is that the way we are going about seeking the end of suffering, seeking relief, seeking happiness, seeking balance, seeking self-understanding or knowledge, that the very movement or mechanism in consciousness that is wanting to get something is actually what's taking us away from realizing it. Now, where this gets I don't know what the adjective is that I want to use, where it gets interesting, complicated, tragic, is if we look at the way meditation is kind of marketed and shared today in the world, what we realize is, what we see is that the whole kind of industry that's grown up around mindfulness and meditation and wellness is essentially preying on this pattern. I will be better when, I will be happier when, I will be fulfilled when, I will be at peace when, I will be more lovable, more likable, more acceptable when I'm a better meditator, I can concentrate, I've realized stream entry, I've realized the jhanas, I've practiced the Brahmaviharas, whatever it is, however it occurs to us. The message underneath so many of the kind of ways that meditation gets presented is either feel better, do this and you will feel better. And again, the paradox there that yes, there's truth to that. And yet the mechanism pointing to the future, taking us out of the present. We're looking in the wrong direction. Or become better, be a better version of you, a happier version of you, a more attractive, lovable, intelligent, balanced, peaceful version of you. This is the self-improvement project that is insidious, that finds its way into our meditation practice. So I invite you to take a look, to check and see, to what degree is this present for you in your meditation? How much is it driven by a sense of improving yourself? I want to become, I will be. And there's that carrot on the stick receding. The goal keeps moving into the distance. So I want to unpack this a little bit. I want to explore it and reference it back to the teachings, and also kind of complicate it, because it's there's a paradox at the heart of it. Suzuki Roshi, the Soto Zen teacher who wrote Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, put it very simply, in a very pithy way, to his students. He said, "You're all perfect just as you are. And there's room for improvement." So there's a sense that both are true, right? Of course we could be happier. Of course we could be kinder, more patient, more loving, more honest, more self-aware. All of these things are true. And the path does produce those results. The more we practice, the less self-centered we become, the less violent we become, the more understanding, patient, honest, kind. All of these things do come to pass, but they don't come by grasping, by reaching for them. They come by awakening to the way things are in the present, by exploring what it is to be alive here and now. The shift is from one of reaching into the future to try to get something or become something, to turning the attention back into the present to see what we already are. And the Buddha was very clear about this. He talked about three kinds of desire, and desire is not actually really the right word, three kinds of compulsive thirst. Tanha, three kinds of compulsive thirst that take us out of the present and propel us into an imagined future. So one is the thirst for sensory stimulation, for pleasant sights, sounds, smells, tastes, and touches. And this is one of the kind of driving forces of the modern capitalist market economy. The Buddha saw this 2 millennia ago, before capitalism was even dreamed of. He says the world is driven by craving. Craving for what? Craving for pleasure, for a new car, for a nice house, for a pleasant meal, for a new shirt, for nice things, for pleasant experiences. And it's that movement towards something that we want to consume something, to have something, to get something pleasant for ourselves. This is one primary kind of program or patterning in consciousness that keeps us locked in this cycle of missing our life, of always waiting for something and never quite getting there. It's called dukkha. It means it doesn't quite scratch the itch, whatever it is. There's pleasure in it. Yes, absolutely, we experience pleasure in life. But does anything ever really do it for us in that lasting way? We always want another one. Then the second force of this, the second place, this kind of compulsive thirst shows up is more the domain that I'm talking about, which is called bhava tanha. It's the thirst to be someone, to become something. I will be the best meditation teacher. Everyone will love me. I will become attractive, beautiful. I will have a beautiful this. It's the sense of being someone in the future. We imagine ourselves becoming something, and then we move towards it. And in that movement towards an imagined future, we leave the treasure that's available in the present, our own capacity for peace, for contentment, for awakening, driven on by the incessant desire to have or become or get something. The third one is the opposite force, the force to not be something. So this shows up as, you know, certain perceptions of ourself. I don't want to be a failure. I don't want to be arrogant. Oh no, I'm not arrogant. Like, don't think of me that way. We want to separate ourselves to not be something. And the deepest way that force shows up is just the desire to not exist at all. That feeling of just wanting everything to stop, just make it go away, just let me go to sleep and just make it all stop. This desire to not exist, to make it go away. So the self-improvement project is a manifestation of these deeper forces in consciousness, primarily this bhava tanha, this force to become something, to become better in the future. I had a very powerful realization on one retreat, the first long meditation retreat I sat. I was doing walking meditation in between things. It wasn't even kind of doing formal walking meditation. I was walking like from the dining hall to the meditation room or something, but practicing, walking, being very present. It was very deep into the retreat. The mind was very quiet, receptive. And there in the space of listening and connecting with the heart, I was kind of tracking this feeling of waiting, of wanting to what? Wanting what? I was kind of listening for what it was and realizing that there was this deep longing to become enlightened. Why? But it was this why? What is it? And underneath it, there was this ache of wanting love and acceptance from my mom. If only I would become enlightened. Then she would accept me. And she would see me, she would love me. So even enlightenment, awakening, the idea of it can become an obstacle when it becomes co-opted by this self-improvement, by this, I will become, and then. This was at a time in my life where my relationship with my mom was still very, very fraught. As I mentioned earlier, I grew up in a Jewish family, so practicing Buddhism was not exactly what a Jewish mom wishes for her son. And so there was a lot of pain and misunderstanding in our relationship, which has since just been a tremendous amount of healing. And I feel very loved and accepted by my mom today. I'm very grateful to say, whether or not I ever got enlightened. But it was a very powerful moment for me to recognize that here I was practicing so diligently, and then there's this small boy inside just wanting his mommy to love him. The more we examine this, the more we become conscious of this pattern, of this desire to become something. What we start to see is that the thing we're wanting to fix, the personality, me, the sense of self, is unfixable. That the project is doomed. Because the very thing that we're trying to improve, to make shiny and attractive and lovable and perfect and dazzling, is in and of itself incomplete. What is the self? What does it mean to be Oren or David or Sarah, or whoever you are, whoever we are? What is the personality? It's a line that we draw around experience, isn't it? Take a look. The sense of me is a limitation. It's a way that we separate from life, from the whole, from this field of experience, from nature. The personality is always defined in opposition to something else, me and you, me and the world. So there's always going to be a sense of separation, a sense of being incomplete, because by definition, that's what a self is. That's what a personality is it's a limitation, a kind of a boundary around something. Not only that, what holds it together? How do we form that boundary? How does the self, the sense of me, get created? Through this action in the mind and the heart. It has to be. It's a contraction. It's a quality of clinging that creates the sense of me. So there's always going to be a certain quality of insecurity to it, because it's not solid. It's held together temporarily, and it's always changing. So its nature, the very nature of the thing we are trying to fix and improve, is fundamentally insecure, changing, separate. And the gift, the potential for the meditation, for the spiritual path, is to see and understand the nature of it, to see, that's all it is. And that the heart is actually already free. That awareness, this wakeful quality, isn't defined by the personality, by the self, even by these programs, these patterns of wanting to become something. Those two occur in awareness. They are known, felt, and pass away in awareness. One of my first meditation teachers, Indian man by the name of Anagarika Manindraji, he was fond of quoting the Buddha and saying that Sakkaya Ditti, which is the personality view, self view, the idea of being someone, is the number one obstacle on this path. Believing in the idea that I am someone who is meditating, who is going to become better and enlightened in the future, that very foundation, if we're approaching the practice from that place, that's an obstacle. He said it's like sitting in a rowboat and you're rowing and you're rowing and you're rowing until finally someone points out, you might want to unmoor the boat from the dock. As long as we're holding on to this idea of being someone who's going to get or become something in the future, we're going in the wrong direction. Ryokan has a poem. He says, Buddha is your mind, and the great way leads nowhere. Search no further than this. If you point your cart north when you want to go south, how will you ever arrive? If we point our cart north, if we look to the future, which by definition hasn't arrived, it never arrives, it's always a thought. If we point our cart north when we want to go south, when we want to realize the truth of what it is to be alive and awake and human in this moment, how will we ever arrive? We're going in the wrong direction. The Buddha described the Dhamma. He said, Dhamma is sanditiko, akaliko. Akaliko means timeless. What we are seeking does not exist in time. It's not to be found in the past or the future or even the present. It's beyond the concepts of time. Akaliko, sanditiko means apparent here and now. It's right here. It's not something new that has to come into existence. It's something that's so fundamentally available and present that it's about returning to it. So every time we buy into the narrative of the self-improvement project, we move further from the goal. And the practice is one of turning the mind back on itself to discover, what is it to be here? What is it to be alive? What is it to be awake? What is it to have a mind and body? And it's by being available and receptive to that, that we awaken to the truth in the present moment, in the here and the now. I thought I would end with a poem from the Tibetan tradition by Lama Gendun Rinpoche. This is called Free and Easy, a Spontaneous Vajra Song. It's another way of talking about or describing what I've been sharing with you today. Happiness cannot be found through great effort and willpower, but is already present in open relaxation and letting go. Don't strain yourself. There is nothing to do or undo. Whatever momentarily arises in the body-mind has no real importance at all, has little reality whatsoever. Why identify with and become attached to it, passing judgment upon it and ourselves? Far better to simply let the entire game happen on its own, springing up and falling back like waves, without changing or manipulating anything. And notice how everything vanishes and reappears magically, again and again, time without end. Only our searching for happiness prevents us from seeing it. It's like a vivid rainbow which you pursue without ever catching, or a dog chasing its own tail. Although peace and happiness do not exist as an actual thing or place, it is always available and accompanies you every instant. Don't believe in the reality of good and bad experiences. They are today's ephemeral weather, like rainbows in the sky. Wanting to grasp the ungraspable you exhaust yourself in vain. As soon as you relax, as soon as you open and relax this tight fist of grasping, infinite space is here, open, inviting, and comfortable. Make use of this spaciousness, this freedom and natural ease. Don't search any further, looking for the great awakened elephant who is already resting quietly at home in front of your own hearth. Nothing to do or undo, nothing to force, nothing to want, and nothing missing. Hey, Maho, marvelous. Everything happens by itself. So thank you so much for your kind attention. Please take what's useful and the rest just leave aside. So I want to share again this invitation that Caroline shared at the beginning to support this amazing community of Sangha Live that makes these teachings available and accessible at no cost. It's keeping in the tradition of the Dharma for over 2 millennia that has been shared freely across the generations and continents. And so the only way that I'm here with you, the only way that Caroline and Sangha Live is making this happen is because other people before today have donated. So all of us here today are the recipients of the generosity of people who've come before us. And so there's the invitation, not the obligation, the invitation to pay it forward. That if you would like, if you feel moved to support this community and these teachings, my work, my practice, that you're invited to make a contribution of any amount so that this can continue. And I think there should be a button there on the screen to offer a donation. So we have some time for questions, and you can put those in the little Q&A panel there on the screen, on the Crowdcast, and Caroline will relay those to me in writing, and I will do my best to respond, to share something that I hope would be useful or supportive. So Caroline, any questions that you'd like to post in the chat here for me? Happy to respond to those.
Hi, Oren, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
I've posted a whole list of questions in the chat. Can you not see them?
No, maybe you posted them to Sangha Live, to the host. You didn't post them to me.
Oh, okay.
It looks like maybe you posted them privately.
Okay, let me
see if you can, if you copy, if you click on the side and copy, then you can paste it again to everyone or to me.
Okay.
To see them. Great. I was wondering, I was like, wow, there are no questions. There we go.
Can you see one now? Okay, great. I'll post the others
in. Yeah, okay. So great. So this first question is wonderful from Carrie. If the journey is the goal, how do we set goals and move towards those goals while letting go of the outcome? Beautiful question. Thank you. So this is the paradox and the nuance and what we're practicing, because both are true. Of course we set goals, right? We exist in time. Like today's Sunday. We're all going back to work tomorrow on Monday, right? So we set goals. And we take the steps that we need to in our life to move towards those, whether those goals are material, emotional, spiritual, right? It's important to set goals. I'm going to meditate every day for 45 minutes in the morning for the next week, or I'm going to chant the Metta Sutta. We set goals for ourselves. The key, though, is that then we allow the goal to just be like a beacon. We orient towards it, but we give our attention to where we are. Because the fulfillment and the realization is in the present, whatever the goal is, whether it's a material goal in time, like, you know, I want to save X number of dollars so that I can donate to Giving Well this year and support this project. The experience is what nourishes us, being present for our life. And it's the same with working for social change. You know, this practice where we come to open to the truth as it is doesn't mean we don't seek to make change in the world. It means that we come into relationship with what is from a place of balance and love so that we can act with clarity rather than with reactivity. Okay, Jen P. is asking, my grief over my dad with dementia is so complicated. He's alive, but the person I loved is not there. I need help with acceptance and how to grieve. Thank you for sharing the tenderness of your heart and of what you're living with your dad. And just taking a moment to just honor the weight of that. The grief is complicated, as you said. It's not simple, and it's different for each of us. And it's so personal how it unfolds. And I think that the best thing we can do is really to just give ourselves space to be wherever we are in that journey, whether it's feeling numb or angry or overwhelmed or the sadness and pain, and let it come. So this is another subtlety in practice, is that, you know, yeah, everything changes, and yet our task, our invitation is to open the heart, to allow ourselves to be present to and feel the waves of whatever comes through. So my wish for you, my blessing for you would be to allow yourself and to reach out to find the support and the conditions to allow yourself to be just where you are. It's like walking in the dark sometimes, I think, grieving. We can't see ahead. We don't know what's coming or where we're going. But if we can feel our way, just feel our way one moment, one step at a time. And as much as possible to really listen to your heart to see, you know, what do I need? What would be supportive? And sometimes that's company. Sometimes it's other people. Sometimes it's solitude. Sometimes it's nature. Sometimes it's tears. So I offer a lot of tenderness, and I hope that that you can give yourself that space at times and find the support that you need, Jen. So a few more here. So Caroline, that's probably enough. There's no way I'll get to all of these. So I'll just do my best here, going one at a time. How do you balance the duality that we are perfect as we are and that we need to improve? I almost never feel that I am perfect as I am in the moment, which leads to disappointment and suffering because my focus tends to be on feeling that I need fixing or improving. Ira. Yeah, well, that's the very place of practice right there, Ira. The personality will always feel like it needs to be fixed because that's its nature. It will never feel perfect because it isn't. The perfection is not in the personality, it's in awareness. So go back to that meditation on sound. Listen really carefully and then notice the listening. Notice the part of your heart and mind that is receptive, that's present, that's wakeful, that's receiving the sounds. That same wakeful, sensitive awareness receives the personality, our history, our foibles. But the awareness itself is not the personality. The awareness is free. That's what's perfect in and of itself. It's complete. It doesn't need anything. It's not defined by the content of experience, but rather it's the ground out of which experience arises. So this is the investigation, one way of investigating in practice. And then the pain, the disappointment of I'm not good enough, that needs to be held in awareness. That in and of itself, it's like a knot. It's like an energetic knot. It can't be fixed, but it can be released. So the part that says, I'm not good enough, I need to be better, people don't like me, there's something wrong with me. We can add, you know, a little of this, a little of that to make the personality more likable, and to kind of practice tends to smooth the rough edges of the self naturally. The more we follow that impulse, I need to be, it just gets tighter. We're feeding the pattern. We have to become aware of the pattern itself, hold that pain in awareness, because that in and of itself is a certain energetic contraction in the heart and the mind and the psyche that can be known and whose nature is to pass, to release, to open. It's just what it is. Feeling inadequate is just an experience of pain, feeling small, ashamed, and then it passes. It's really unpleasant, but it's not who we are. And that's something that each of us can discover and can know for ourselves directly through the practice of wakeful awareness and compassion, to hold that place in your heart tenderly. And just, oh, this too. Here is this sweet, tender Ira who longs for this. And to just love that person in awareness. And eventually your heart and mind will recognize that the awareness and the loving is not Ira. Ira is included within that. And then that's the release of the heart. Hope that's helpful. From Vikas, the being mode meditation appears to help deepen our direct experience so that we can see things more clearly / as they are. But we also want to understand and make sense out of what we are now seeing more clearly. And the thinking mind kicks in. Do you have a recommendation or advice for a meditative practice separate from being experiencing mindfulness meditation to process, analyze, and deepen understanding of ourselves and the nature of reality? So let me just kind of rephrase it a little, make sure I'm following. It sounds like you're pointing to, yes, there's this being mode where we are receptive, and then the content of experience becomes more clear, whether it's some situation in our life, a social issue, a pattern in ourself. And then you're saying like, well, but then what kind of, like, do I just be with that too? When do we actually kind of understand the thing better? So there are different, I hope that's what you're asking. That's what I'm hearing. I hope I've got it right, because I would say there are two different parts to it in my experience, in my understanding. One is if you just allow that experience. So let's make it concrete. Let's say, like for me, one of the things in my personality, the way it's been formed is not sharing my vulnerability, kind of hiding behind, I'm okay, I'm good. Yeah, I'm fine. How are you? You know, or like a role, like, so teaching, and I'm teaching, everything's okay. And not sharing, you know, like, oh, I feel insecure, or like, do people like me? Or, gosh, I'm having a hard time with this family member who's struggling. So I can become aware of this pattern. Let's call it hiding or performing. So there's one part that just holding it in awareness without trying to do anything, the nature of wakeful awareness, it's not neutral, it's loving and it's intelligent. It wants to understand naturally. There's a quality to awareness that is wisdom, that's discerning. So just holding that particular patterning or issue in wakeful awareness allow it to reveal itself, allow it to unfold, just holding the space of awareness, and learning will occur. So this is one method, one way. Another way, another method is through active inquiry. So there's a certain amount of concentration present, stability in the mind, and then you can inquire. And the inquiry is not discursive, it's not thinking about, but it uses the discursive mind to kind of point the attention. So for example, with that issue that I gave, I might drop a question in to the psyche, like, what are you afraid of? And then just listen. So this is a method of inquiry whereby we listen for what's a question that might open something or shift our perspective or reveal something. Ask the question, and then again, stay with the listening. And the listening is, I've given talks about this. You can probably find them on Dharma Seed or maybe on my website on the audio page about the process of inquiry. The listening is it's an inquisitive receptivity. The analogy that I like to use is if you want to know if like a plant or a flower is real or fake, you don't think about it, but you pay very close attention. It's that quality of listening. These are great questions. I'm really enjoying them. Okay, another one from Abdullah. Just a thought, how do you deal with the confusion of ego gurus that scam others with preying on the imagined future and the ideal self? Ignore and don't engage, i.e. also the companies and advertisers themselves. Tolerance? Yeah. You know, it's tragic the way this happens, you know, selling enlightenment. But the world is not in our control, of course. So yes, I think in one regard, you just steer clear of it. At the same time, I think we have a responsibility to those in our lives who we have a relationship with. And so if we see someone going down a path that we're concerned about, then to find a way to express our concern in a respectful and loving way. But for the most part, you know, my approach, I don't know that this is the right approach, but the world is out of control. It's not, you know, again, it's not that we don't take steps to make change in our world, you know, like this George Floyd policing act present here in the United States right now, which is wonderful. I hope it passes in Congress, you know, calling senators to support it. We all need to apply ourselves to make change. And so if you think someone is causing harm, then absolutely, you know, step forward, engage, let others know. And there's a certain amount, particularly in the spiritual realm, that's beyond our control, and people are going to do what they're going to do. So just focus on your own practice. From Denny Madi, is it undesirable to have any ambition or personal goals, i.e. what if you're financially insecure and you need to find a better job? No, absolutely. As I said earlier, of course we need goals. It's how we operate in the world. Have goals. Take steps to improve your life. Take steps to, you know, help those you love, to improve your situation, to improve your community. Absolutely. The what I hope you take away from today is two things. When it comes to the material world, when we set goals, set the goal and then focus on what you're doing in the present. The outcome isn't up to us because there are too many variables. Don't place your hope or your sense of meaning or success on the outcome. Place your focus on the wholeheartedness of your effort and the sincerity and skill of your execution, because that's what we have control over. So that's in the material domain, in the social domain. In the spiritual domain, similarly, of course we set goals. It's beautiful to have the aspiration to realize enlightenment, to open the heart, to make the heart and the mind as beautiful and radiant as possible by cultivating the beautiful qualities. But be on the lookout for when aspiration, which is an orientation towards deepening, when aspiration becomes expectation and craving in towards the future. The direction of the practice is always turning towards the present. That's where the deepening happens, not by moving towards a goal in the future. The name of the poem, I would like to read it again. Yes, the name of the poem, and perhaps you can put this in the chat for everyone, Caroline, is Free and Easy, a Spontaneous Vajra Song, and it's by Venerable Lama Gendun Rinpoche. Free and Easy, a Spontaneous Vajra Song. You can probably find it online. It's a really wonderful poem. From Rob, in light of what you said, what would you say to someone who's on the fence about starting to meditate? In other words, how would you increase someone's motivation or desire to meditate? Yeah, great question. There's another analogy in the Buddhist world. I think it comes from the Lotus Sutra, which is a Mahayana text, where the Buddha is like a parent and their children are in the house playing with toys. And the house is on fire. And the children don't want to stop playing with their toys because the room where they're in, there's no fire. So the Buddha says to the children, "Hey, I have the most amazing toy outside. It's the best toy you've ever, ever seen. It's this whole beautiful world with a train set and a castle. And come, I want to show you." And the children get all excited and they follow him. They get out of the house and they get out of the house and there's no toy. There's no train set. But the house is burning and they're safe now. So sometimes this is an analogy that's used to explain the way enlightenment gets marketed in the spiritual realm. It's like we're like the children playing with our toys, like, you know, let's go get a new plant and put it on the patio and let's make a beautiful dinner. And we're so consumed by the objects and the experiences of the world that we don't realize that everything's changing and passing so quickly, and we're all mortal and we're going to lose everything that's important to us. And so the Buddha's saying, "Oh, I've got this great thing. This is the best thing you'll ever have. It's called enlightenment. It's going to make you so happy. You're going to feel so good. You'll be totally at peace. Come on, I'll show you." And so we practice and we meditate and we practice and we meditate until we let go. And we realize enlightenment. We realize there's nothing there, but then we're free. We're not bound anymore by the world. So this is a long way of answering your question. There's a certain skill, I think, in finding, like, what is it that the person longs for? What is it that they need? We're all suffering, and pointing to, you know, there is this possibility of suffering less by understanding your own heart and mind. And there is truth in that. We do suffer less from the practice. So for me, that's something where I feel like I'm being honest. I'm not trying to deceive someone, rather than saying, "Oh, this is going to make you happy. This is going to make everything better." Oh, maybe. Yeah, but we can suffer less. Okay, my friends. We're coming to the end of our time here. I want to thank you for joining, for your beautiful questions, for your kind attention. Again, if you'd like to support Sangha Live and my work, invitation to offer a contribution of any kind. And if you'd like to stay in touch, you're free to visit me online on my website or social media. I do have a couple of retreats coming up. Next month, May, I'm teaching the Loving Kindness Retreat with Sharon Salzberg and others at the Insight Meditation Society. It will be online. Registration is open for that. And then in June, I'm also teaching a smaller retreat with a limited registration with more kind of one-to-one guidance with Matthew Brensilver, Insight Meditation Retreat, and the information for that is on my website. So thank you so much for joining. I hope you have a safe and enriching rest of your day, and many blessings to each of you in your practice. May you realize the fruit of awakening in your own heart and mind. Okay, take care, everyone. Be well. Hope to see you again. Many blessings.